What I want to talk about really is the Apostle Paul was the Apostle to the Gentiles. That's no big news to any of us. We know that. He was the Apostle to the Gentiles. If you want a scripture for that, it's Romans 11 and verse 13. I might as well read it since I pointed it out. See that it's stated right there directly. Not that we don't know that, but Romans 11 and verse 13 says, "For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, I magnify my ministry." It's stated point blank there. Now, over and over he says that he is the apostle in the churches there. No doubt about that. Now, I mention that simply for the reason that I want to talk about the Apostle Paul in a way of how did he deal with in the churches. He dealt with the church in Rome, and that's the one I want to talk about probably primarily today. And he never had even been there. I'm going to show you that. And he wrote this epistle to Rome, to the Roman church, and he hadn't even been to the church. But that didn't mean he didn't get any communication, because they did have some communication, not like we have today, but some communication about what was going on in some of these various places. Now, he had that, but you all remember that the Apostle Paul was on his way down to Damascus when he was struck down. I don't believe I have to rehearse that. He went on his way down when he was struck down and changed and converted very suddenly. Now, I mention this because he became a different man almost instantly, you see, right then and there on the spot. And he was a serious man. I take nothing away from that because he obviously was very serious. He was serious in what he was doing. He believed, I feel very truly that he believed he was doing what was right, up until suddenly he was struck down and pointed out that he was fighting the wrong thing. Now, I want to turn to the ninth chapter of Acts, just for that one verse, when he was struck down. And what was he told? That was what I want to point out. The ninth chapter of Acts and verse 15. I just want to turn to that one, because Ananias was told to go to this place and to see this man, Saul of Tarsus. And Ananias was a little bit reluctant about that. "I heard about this guy. You know, I know about him. He was out there and he had orders from the high priest to persecute the Christians. And that's why he came down to Damascus in the first place." God says, "All right, he's a chosen vessel of mine. You go on down there." Verse 15 is the only one I want to quote here. "But the Eternal said to him," to Saul of Tarsus, and he said that to Ananias to go there. He says, "Go, for he is a chosen vessel," the one that became the Apostle Paul. It was Saul of Tarsus here. "He is a chosen vessel of mine to hear my name before whom? Gentiles, kings, and the children of Israel. For I will show him how many things he must suffer for my name's sake." Now, he was going to bring plenty of sufferings, and already did, upon the Christians. And I don't mean was revenge in God's way of going at it or anything like that, because God says vengeance is mine. But he did show him how he had to suffer and was willing to do it. Now, I think that he got the picture very clearly, the Apostle Paul did, that whatever he had to suffer was sort of what he had brought upon others that were serious about the Christian faith. Now, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Rome. I know this was covered in Bible studies and some time ago, and I'm not going to go through the book of Romans. That's not my purpose at all. I want to talk about the Apostle Paul's attitude about one of the problems in the church there right off the bat. That's the thing I want to cover, and I don't want to go through the book, the whole book. It's a rather interesting book, incidentally, a rather thorough book whenever you consider all of the things that he brought out. When he had never ever been to the church, and he wrote to the church for this letter to be read, obviously, to them, in the first chapter of Romans, I want to start, and I'll start in verse 8. It says, "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for you all." He was a pretty good southerner, too, you see. He could say y'all, and for Jesus Christ for you all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole cosmos, throughout the whole world, as he says. That's an interesting point. Rome was, the capital of the world at that time, the civilized world. And so the word goes out from there and went out everywhere. And so they were spoken of everywhere. That church was pretty widely known. For God is my witness, verse 9 says, whom I serve with my spirit. Whose spirit? With my spirit. The spirit in Paul, the spirit in man. I wonder if you catch that when you read these things. He says, with my spirit in the gospel of his Son, that without ceasing I might make mention of you always in my prayers. Now, with my spirit, his spirit wasn't always directed that way. Let's face it, honestly. When he was going down to Damascus to persecute the Christians, his spirit wasn't oriented to do the gospel of Jesus Christ. But he has changed here. Now, with my spirit, well then there's a changing of the spirit, if you please. And I mention that here because I want to show you a little bit further about that as we go on. A changing of our minds and hearts and how we also have to be converted. All of us have to follow that pattern. But he says that, the last part of the verse says, that without ceasing I make mention of you always in my prayers. That means he was on his knees 24 hours a day all the time praying for them. Come on. You know better than that. What does that really mean when he says we pray always for you? Well, it obviously means that whenever anything that comes to mind related to them in any way, instantly he was prayerful toward those people. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I've mentioned that we come in all walks of life. I was ordained even before I was, while I was still a supervising engineer at a power company out in California, and I didn't spend all my time, 24 hours a day, praying for the church, I can assure you. I had supervision of several departments, and I was getting calls from all over the world, from engineers, actually, really. Engineers from Chile and Mexico, and had one engineer from Taiwan come and sit in the office with me for a week one time to see how we did things. And so I was getting calls from everywhere. And I was going out to district superintendents and operating superintendents all over the whole power system all the time. And busy is what I'm saying. Couldn't have my mind oriented always on the work of God as far as that part was concerned. Now, When did I pray always for the church and pray always for you, for that matter? Or you pray for me? Because whenever it comes up and the first thought on our mind needs to be that direction. Can I put it that way simply? That's what it really boils down to. In other words, we have to go through the process of converting the spirit in man to where it's oriented that way instead of all of the selfishness of Satan's world in which we live. We rub shoulders all day with people in this world, and we have to live in it. But we have to come out of it, too, and not be a part of it. Well, I want to go a little further here. Verse 10, making request, if by some means now at last I may find a way in the will of God to come to you. He had never been there. Now, he had been the apostle of the Gentiles all over Asia Minor and Illyrium, I think is the name of what he names them here, another place. But and they knew this, as far as that goes. They knew of his office and position, but he had never been there with them. Now, what was his mind and attitude then? He wrote a letter. The Apostle Paul apparently wasn't a man that was real impressive as far as a speaker is concerned. He kind of fell in my category, I guess. I'm sort of a dunce when it comes to being a prominent orator. But he wrote a powerful pen. Now, I mentioned that because God chose that man, I think, probably primarily for that reason. He was a prolific writer. He could write. Now, I remember I was at a ministerial conference one time when Mr. Ted Armstrong was there presiding. And he's talking about this very thing about writing. He said, my father, Mr. Herbert Armstrong, probably wrote more things, if you wanted the volume of them, more things than all of the prophets in the whole Bible combined, including the Apostle Paul that wrote more of the books of the Bible than any other, and probably many times over more material than that, which he probably did. Now, I know all of you have actually heard of Mr. Armstrong and Good News magazine we have now, of course, but we had a Good News magazine then also in worldwide days. But there was the Plain Truth was the main magazine that was the publication that went out to some 8 million people. And Mr. Armstrong almost invariably throughout all of the many, 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 many years that that thing was published, that he wrote the lead articles on it. And if you were to stack all of that stuff up, you would have a volume, a library of information that was a lot of writings. Now, they didn't have printing presses back in those days either. And so I don't mean to say that they couldn't have done it, but the apostle, the only reason I'm pointing that out is that God chooses the kind of a man that can write effectively. Mr. Armstrong could, and the Apostle Paul could. 2 Corinthians, the 10th chapter. I'll turn to that, and I'll come right back here. 2 Corinthians, chapter 10, and verse 10. 10:10. I had it before, so I remember it. It says, talking about the Apostle Paul and what they say about him, it says, for his letters, they say, are weighty and powerful, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech contemptible. Well, rather interesting. It wasn't that he couldn't speak, because he did. He spoke powerfully, too, to the Jews right after he was converted down in Damascus. And you can read that in Acts. But I won't go into that. But I pointed out the fact that he was able to write powerfully. He wrote to the Roman church then, as the apostle, had never been there. But he still wrote points of correction. Where did he get the knowledge that this was needed? Well, it had to come from someone. They did travel back and forth, you know, to Rome. And Rome was, as I said, the hub of the world, or the capital of the world, you might say, back in those days. And so he got information about what was going on in the church to some extent. And one of the themes that I want to, that's what I want to talk about, is that he brought out very early in all of this. I stopped in verse 10, but I want to read a couple more verses in verse 11. For I long to see you, that I may impart to you some spiritual gift, so that you may be established. That is, that I may be encouraged. I want to dwell on this verse just a little bit. I want you to look at this verse carefully. That is, that I may be encouraged. He wants to come there with these people. That I may be encouraged together with you by the mutual faith. Both you and I. I said I wanted to point that verse out. What was he saying? Brethren, I wonder if you realize what an inspiration it is to us sometimes just to come among you. I have said from the very beginning, the first sermon I gave in these churches way back in 1995 was the fact that you don't think just exactly like I think. God made us that way. Nothing wrong with that. You see, your whole environmental background may be altogether different, and all of the circumstances in your life shape your whole way of thinking, and some of the facets of that are different than the way I think about things. There's no doubt about that. We don't have to. Your fingerprints are different than anybody else's in the whole world, even though there are, what, over 6 billions of people. Makes no difference. So you don't think exactly the same. Now, when I come along and tell you, and I've told you this many times over, I want to know how you think about some of these things, because I learn from that. Now, I hope that you can learn from some of the ways that I think, too, as far as that goes. And if I'm to be the teacher, of course, I hope that you're to learn. I've never had a problem with that, even when I was a supervising engineer. I didn't have a problem with my men. I didn't have to come around and say, well, I'm the boss around here, you know. The Apostle Paul didn't go at it that way either. Did Jesus Christ go at it that way? I never see an example of where he ever came at it that way at all. The Apostle Paul didn't either. He explains a problem here, and he spends a considerable amount of time doing it, and then he gets down to saying, now we need to stop that one. Excuse me, but I'll get to that later and point that out to you. What was the problem? Well, we get an introduction to it if we just go over to chapter 2 and verse 1. Now what did I do? Therefore, you are inexcusable, O man, whoever you are, who judge. Now, what is that judge business? Well, mainly it means discerning difficulties that were there. I'll get down to that a little later about it. But judge, it doesn't mean that you're sentencing somebody to a prison sentence or anything like that, judging in that way. It means that you see something that is going on in someone else, and you discern that you didn't like that. And we need to watch that kind of a frame of mind and attitude. Now, that Apostle Paul's going to deal with that rather thoroughly before he gets done. I won't go into the 7th chapter where he says, the things I would, I do not, and the things I would not, that I do, and all of this kind of stuff, where he had problems just the same as you and I have, and no doubt about that, of that conscience drifting off at various times and seeing various things. We all have the same difficulty. But here was a problem that he was addressing right from the beginning. Look out, you're inexcusable, O man. And he's writing to the Roman church here. Whoever you are that judge, for in whatever you judge another, you condemn yourselves. For you who judge, practice the same things. interestingly enough, a lot of times we'll see something that I don't like that particular thing in that person. We ought to turn it around. They see things that they don't like in you too, just probably as a result of that very kind of interrelationship that's wrong. Maybe we ought to think about that. That's not Christian. That's not what we want. Now the Apostle Paul is going to get down to that here. And that's what I want to mainly talk about today is how he dealt with that kind of situation. Verse 2. But we know that the judgment of God is according to truth against those who practice such things. And we don't want God's judgment upon us against anything like that. We don't want that kind of thing to go on. We just ought to look at my notes once in a while, maybe. Let's go to chapter 14. No, let's chapter 12. I want to go to chapter 12 of Romans first. Chapter 12, kind of in line with getting the frame of mind and attitude that we need to have facing these little difficulties that come up with problems. I'll talk about more of that a little later, but in preliminary and getting set for this, teaching them, the Apostle Paul in chapter 12 says in verse 1, I beseech you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. Now, we need to do that. That's reasonable that we should do that sort of thing. And do not be conformed to this world. We live in it. You rub shoulders with it day in and day out. But we should not be conformed to it. Not the way they conduct themselves. And we need to be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. If we were to reach that point of acceptance with God perfectly, and we try more perfectly all the time with what we want to do, but if we reach it more perfectly, we could be like Christ, and when they started to stone him to death, he walked right out of their midst and with no problem. The perfect will of God? Well, that isn't quite the way we go at it. You see, I have been, I don't want to confess all of that to you people, but I was a kind of a rugged individual when I was younger, back in my young days. I don't mean violent or, abusive in one sense of the word. But if somebody crossed my mind, I'd get back to them, well, you dirty so-and-so, I'll get you. That's wrong. Absolutely wrong. We don't want that. Now, that's what the Apostle Paul is dealing with. The conscience needs to be trained not to do that, not to do this way. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That's what we need. And let's see. For I say through the grace given me, on verse 3 here of Romans 12, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to everyone a measure of faith. For as we have many members and one body, and all of the members do not have the same function. Obviously, he's talking about groups of people. We don't all have the same function, but we all should recognize that we're all a part of the body that Jesus Christ, the body of his church. And we may think differently, and we do. We may think about various things in different ways, just like the fingers are a different part of the body than the toes, or the feet different than the hands, and so forth, and so forth, and so forth. The different functions of the body, so there are differences in the things that we need to do And what he is really getting down to is how do we relate to those things between one another? Do we accept one another's differences in all of these various categories? This is the nature of the problem he's dealing with here when we get down to a little further. Where am I? Verse 4. For as we have many members in one body, but all the members do not have the same function, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and individually members of one another. We need to recognize that as far as we are concerned. I think it's verse 16 I want now. I'll check this out here. Oh, verse 9, I guess. I'll pick it up there. Let love be without hypocrisy. Now, you go out here in this world, and the way they look at love, boy, it's about as hypocritical as it can possibly be. You see, a vacuum sweeper salesman will come to your door, and he just loves you if you'll buy that vacuum sweeper. You see, they come at you with all kinds of charismatic kind of ways to get you to do what they want, and that's about all there is to it, really, when you get right down to it. That's hypocrisy. That's love in hypocrisy. Love truly is outgoing if it's godly love. Love for the other person rather than self. Love outgoing. That's the way it should be. There's no hypocrisy then. It's going the other way. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. In honor, giving preference to one another. Not easy to do. To instantly come up, especially if someone crosses your path in the wrong way and rather upsets you, it's a little bit difficult to consider, well, they're better than I am, you see. You don't quite look at it that way, first off. Not in Satan's world, I mean. And that's what we're in. And we're shaped in it and brought up in it. And that's what we need to be transformed from, to get away from that. That's what the Apostle Paul is saying here in these things. I think it's beautiful the way he brings out some of those things. Now, chapter 7, verse 17 here in chapter 12. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. And if it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Sometimes it isn't possible. But most generally it is, if you really accomplish it, if you really do it. It's incredible what happens most of the time whenever you do that. I've had cases like that where it was impossible for me. I couldn't accomplish it, but I've had cases where you would think that it was absolutely impossible, and it wasn't also, as far as that goes. See, he says, beloved, do not avenge yourselves. Don't avenge yourselves. Don't look to self. Look to outward. Look to the other party. Don't avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine. You think God's big enough to handle it if I just leave it in his hands? If I just walk off and leave it in his hands, he'll take care of it. I don't have to do that. I don't have to say, well, I'll fix you, you dirty rascal. You know? That's about the way I lived most of my life, and I'm sorry to say that in times gone by. Now, I've had a process of being converted from that for the last 50 years, too, and so I hope I've changed a little bit anyway. But verse 19, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. That isn't the way we want to do it. We want to do what it says in the latter part here. It says, if he's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. For in so doing, you will bring coals of fire on his head. Now, we'd like to bring the coals of fire, wouldn't we? No, no, no. We need to turn it around. In doing the good things, you will bring him down to the realization that he isn't the one that's doing the right thing. And you need to do that. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And in chapter 13, he deals with the public out and around, and I'm not going into that because that isn't really my main thrust that I want to deal with here. I want to jump right over to chapter 14 and verse 1, when it says, "Receive one who is weak in the faith, but not in doubt, in disputes over doubtful things." I'm reading the New King James. I think your old King James, if you have it in your lap there, it'll say, "with doubtful disputations." What is that? I have the Nelson King James Study Bible, King James, the old King James, and I just looked up that verse in there, and I got a kind of laugh when I read it, because what it says is, don't get into picky things. And that's just about what it means. I thought that was a good explanation. Picky things. You don't deal with the Sabbath and with the doctrinal things that are already set. That isn't what he's involved here. Let's get that in mind right off the bat. So he's talking about picky things. Things that we want to pick apart. If you see something in me, some little picky thing, and you don't like to see that. Now be careful about judging that, you see. That's in God's hands. Leave that alone. I want to read this. I brought the Good News Bible, and I want to read this from the today's English version, not because I worship this thing at all, but I just kind of like the way that it states here that particular verse. Chapter 14 and verse 1. Welcome the person who is weak in the faith, but do not argue with him about his personal opinions. Now, that gets it pretty well. That explains it pretty well. His personal opinion about something may be a little bit different than your opinion about it. Who's right? Well, we ought to talk about it and see. And we're talking about picky things now. That's what he's pointing out. Little individual things that are not doctrinal. You see, we read this and people can take it and then make doctrinal things out of it, but they don't read that first verse for what it literally says. This whole thing is about picky things that he doesn't answer one way or the other. It's just that don't argue about them. That's what he's saying. Let's read it down here. Verse 2. For one believes that he may eat all things, and one who is weak eats only vegetables. Well, which one did he say was right? Well, he didn't. He says these are picky things. Don't worry about it. Get off them picky things. That's what he's saying. He says, let not him who eats despise him who does not eat. And let not him who does not eat judge those who eats, for God has received him. Now, if God has called him, I better be careful about how I judge him, because God's the judge, not me. God knows his mind and attitude and his environmental background, his makeup, and what caused him to be that way, and everything about him. And I don't. There's no question about that. Now, if God has received him, then I better be careful how I deal with that and talk about it. And we can talk about it and like Jesus did. What did Jesus do whenever, I think I covered this the last time I spoke, when the disciples were with him and they were going along and they said, which one of us is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of God? Well, Jesus didn't come along and say, look, I'm the boss around here. He didn't go that way. What did he do? Never said anything. Till he got to the crowd, took a little child and picked him up and says, now unless you become like this little child, you won't even be there. you won't even be in the kingdom. Don't worry about who's the greatest. Don't need to worry about that. I hope and pray that I'm not just battling my lips whenever I tell you people that I love you just as much as you can possibly love me, hopefully, because we're all in the same boat. And I consider you better than self. I better because that's biblical description. It should. If I don't even make it, I want you to make it into God's kingdom. And I mean that hopefully with all my heart. Now, I know in full well if the time actually comes whenever we get right down to being persecuted for the sake that we could change, but God can give us the strength not to also, if we really trust Him. I can assure you of that, absolutely, irrevocably. No doubt about it in my mind. So, He's talking about picky things here and how we need to look at them, how we ought not to look at them. Who are you? Verse 4. Or, let me see, did I read verse 3? Yeah, verse 4. Who are you to judge another man's another's servant? That word servant is not the word that is usually translated doulos or doulon as a servant in terms of a slave or one that becomes that is a paid for servant or something of that nature. This, yes, is a paid for one, but this is more like a man's valet or someone that is a gentleman's gentleman, if I can put it that way, or a lady's personal maid. That's the kind of servant this word is talking about. You can look it up in Strong's and see it if you wish. But who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he'll be able to make, will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. In other words, stay out of God's business. We need to let God do it, not me. And, one person, verse 5, one person esteems one day above another, another esteems every day alike. Picky things we're talking about. We're not talking about the Sabbath. We're talking about little picky issues relating to those things. That's what he's talking about here. I said picky things, doubtful disputations, your King James says. Let everyone be fully convinced in his own mind. Now we need to become fully convinced in our own mind. Otherwise, we're hypocritical about it if we really boil it down. Think about that. That's really what it does boil down to. He who observes the day observes it to the eternal, to the Lord. And he who does not observe the day, to the Lord he does not observe it. He who eats to the Lord. For he gives God thanks, and he who does not eat, to the Lord he does not eat, and give thanks. Now, I know people can take that all apart and take that, but they forget all about the fact that he says right from the beginning we're dealing with picky little issues, not the basic functions. Because he doesn't deal with that at all. If we get a little further, we'll see that a little more clearly, I think, but that's what he's dealing with here. For none of us lives to himself, and no one dies to himself. Verse 7 says, we're all here together, and you have to put up with me as long as God gives me the breath of life, brethren. That's the way it is. And for if we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. And to this end, Christ died and rose and lived again, that he might be the Lord both of the dead and the living. Jesus stopped the mouth of the Sadducees with that one and talked about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And they were dead for thousands of years, and the Sadducees figured they didn't have any more life after that. Jesus stopped them real clearly on that one. That was very interesting. But verse 9, so to this end Christ died and rose again, that he might be the dead and the living. Verse 10, why do you judge your brother? The Apostle Paul was writing this to a church he'd never visited. Why do you judge your brother? They were doing it there. He had word from somehow that was actually going on or had been going on, and he is dealing with it. He explained it quite thoroughly before he ever got there. Then when he gets there, he says, why are you doing this? Or why do you show contempt to your brother? For you shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. For it is written in Isaiah 45 and verse 23, as I live, says the Eternal, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. Everybody is going to one day bow before God. So then let each of us give account of himself to God. Not to one another and pick at one another. If I see old Larry Jacks over here and I see something I don't like about him, hey, it's God's purpose, not mine, to judge whether he's right or wrong. Maybe he's more right than I am. And I need to consider that if I consider him better than me. And that's the structure, the way it's supposed to be as far as... Yeah. Now, we all have to be converted to that. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that now suddenly that you heard that word and you got to change to do that. It don't work that way, and you know that, and I know that. We have to work at it, but we got to know what we're working at and how we need to change that over, and that spirit in man needs to be trained then to be outgoing instead of selfishly, like the Apostle Paul's spirit in man was before he was suddenly converted along the way, and I'm using him as the example here in what he is teaching them. Let's see, verse 13. Therefore, let each of us, let us not judge one another anymore. Now, yeah, that's a pretty blunt statement from the apostle over the Gentiles. Let's don't judge one another anymore. Now, don't discern those picky things. That's what that word, as I said, judge here, doesn't mean I'm going to sentence you to so many years in prison or anything like that. Not that kind of a judgment. But let us not judge one another anymore, but rather remember this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in your brother's way. Don't cause another brother to stumble along the way. Absolutely avoid that one. I know and am convinced by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself, but to him who considers anything to be unclean, to him it's unclean. Well, there's nothing unclean of itself. Oh, brethren, you don't know how I've had to face questions on things like that. It says right there, nothing is unclean. You can eat rattlesnakes, or you can eat pigs, and you can eat anything you want to eat, and it's all clean. That's what it says. No, brethren, you ought to look that word up. Nothing is unclean. Koinos. The same words that Peter used whenever in Acts 10, whenever he saw the sheet coming down, he said, I have never eaten anything koinos or akatharsan, which means not edible. Koinos is that it wasn't sanctified to be eaten, that's all. It wasn't kosher. Excuse me, I'll say it like it is. And that's what it means here. Picky things, that's what I'm getting at. And I poke that at you over and over and over again. I state that to you over and again. Picky things that he's dealing with here. He's concerned that if just some kind of eating causes my brother difficulty, boy, I better not eat that at all. Because I don't want him to think, oops, he's eating something that's wrong before God. And if he were to think that, I'd sooner just not eat it at all and forget it, and not even cause him to even have that kind of a thought come to his mind. Well, verse 15. Yet if your brother is grieved because of your food, you are no longer walking in love. Do not destroy with your food the one for whom Christ died. Therefore, do not let your good be spoken of as evil. For the kingdom of God is not in eating and drinking, but in righteousness and peace and the joy of the Holy Spirit. For he who serves Christ in these things is acceptable to God and approved by men. I cited the case where I was at a ministerial conference, I don't know, probably in the late 60s sometime. I don't even remember exactly when it was. It could have been clear up in the 70s, I don't know. But I was at a ministerial conference, and I knew Glenn White, one of the ministers up in the Northwest. And I knew Glenn. He was, I was going to say his father's name, and I forgot it. He died now, his father, but I knew him also. And Glenn had an alcohol problem. And so he was out of the ministry for a while and dried up. And he came back into the ministry. And it happened that we were at a ministerial conference, and they had a ministerial dinner at the feast, I think it was. They have a special dinner for all of the ministers that are there. And then they serve them a meal and have wine and the works, you see, at that minister's meeting. And Glenn White was there after he had dried out and was back in the ministry. Well, he went over and sat down at a table like one of these, four place, I think, and sitting there all alone. But I just went over there and sat down with him and talked with him because we'd been friends for years before that. And we sat there and talked, and so they came around with the wine bottles and started pouring wine for everybody, and his glass was turned over so that it was down. I just turned mine over too. Glenn looked over and he said, "I might have known you'd do that." I don't know if that's the best example ever, but at least I tried to be an example because I know what it is like to be an alcoholic. I had a brother that's an alcoholic. And it didn't bother me. Now, I like wine. Everybody ought to know that because I grew up, I probably drank wine before I could ever walk. And, because I grew up in a German family and we had it all the time. So I like wine. It's the way it is. And I have it occasionally with my dinner. I don't care who knows that. It's good. I'm not getting drunk on it, though. And I think everybody knows that, too. I hope by now, anyhow. But I liked wine with my dinner, too. But in order for Glenn over there, sitting all alone, I went over and sat down beside him. And I certainly didn't turn my wine glass up because I knew what a temptation that was to him. And because I know what a pull that is on an alcoholic even after he has dried out, the temptation is still there, I can assure you of that. Well, anyhow, it is something of an example of what we ought to do in terms of consideration for others in situations like that. Verse 19, let's see, therefore, let us pursue the things which make for peace and the things by which one may edify another. Do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food. Verse 20 says, all things indeed are pure. Let's keep them that way. That's what he's saying. Not that the rattlesnakes become pure to eat for food. These are picky things he's talking about. Let's keep that in mind instead of getting carried away with one little phrase here that doesn't mean that rattlesnake food is good as I used it. But do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food. All things indeed are pure, but it is evil for the man who eats with offense. What does that mean? Well, if he sees somebody do it and he doesn't believe it's right, I don't think it's right, but I'll do it anyway, that's kind of with offense. He'd better leave it alone. He's better off to leave it alone and not touch it. It is good neither to eat meat, nor to drink wine, nor to do anything which your brother stumbles, or is offended, or is made weak. You have faith, have it to yourself before God. Make sure your conscience is clean before God. That's the important thing about these picky things. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. Get it clear in your mind what is true and right and proper, and stick to it. Now we're talking about picky things, you see, these picky issues. But he who doubts is condemned, verse 23, he's condemned if he eats, because he eats not with faith. He doesn't do it in true faith, for whatever is not of faith is sin. Now, I don't want to stop right there. I want to go on just a little bit. I have any more time? I'm out of time already, huh? No, I'm not out of time. What am I talking about? It says, chapter 15 and verse 1. We then who are strong ought to bear with the scruples of the weak, and not to please ourselves. Now, again, I have the today's English version here. I want to read that one verse in today's English version, just because I think it sort of simplifies it to put it in this kind of language. It says, we who are strong in the faith ought to help the weak to carry their burdens. In other words, be outgoing with it to help them, and let that be our concern of the things. We should not please ourselves. Instead, we should all please our brothers for their own good, in order to build them up in the faith. That's today's English version. That's what our whole Christian life ought to be then, and our conduct ought to be that way. I mentioned the fact that whenever you go out among the public and they see you, just seeing you, decent clean clothes, or at least decent wear, and decent conduct, and all of the things that you do, you think they don't recognize that? Well, they surely do, and the public does. I mentioned to my wife in 1978, we were in Germany, and I was, so impressed. You just walk down the street and you never, ever see a stick of paper, a cigarette butt, or a cigarette paper, anything. You never see anything like that on the street there. It's all clean, just clean. I was really impressed with that. And I mentioned one day that we went to Bondorf. We were living in Schruxy, and we went to Bondorf to the feast. That was 13 kilometers. About 6 miles, a little over 6 miles. And one day we drove down through there, and there's an old piece of a stove, an old range, laying out there. I said, I've never seen any clutter here at all of any kind. What is this junk doing out here along the road like this? It's just very unusual. We went on down to Bondorf and went to services that day. Well, we came back about noon or during the middle of the day. That thing was gone. It was there no more. The road was clean. And that's the way it is. That's the way they keep it over there. I don't know who put that there, but it wasn't there very long, I'll assure you, because we saw it there. But when we came back, it was gone. And people notice things. They notice things about you, too. And I told my wife when we were walking down the street why people would look up at us and they'd see me, and I'd be walking along with a smile on my face, which I usually do, and they'd look up at me. Then they'd stop and look up again. It's unusual to see anybody ever walk down the street with a smile. You never saw anybody over there walk down the street with a smile. And when you did, well, you startled them, you see. They caught that immediately. And people recognize things about your conduct if you realize that. Our conduct needs to be really Christ-like. And they did that with Christ, too. You know, they threatened to kill him for violating the Sabbath, which he obviously didn't do. But why didn't they accuse him more of other things which would be more common as far as we are concerned? Accuse him of having relations with some of those bad women that he dealt with many times and all of that kind of stuff. They couldn't do it because they knew he never did that. Somehow they knew by his conduct that he didn't do that. And it was there, brethren. We need to recognize that. They do recognize things like this whenever they see your Christian conduct. It should be that way. And that's the way ours ought to be. We ought to do this at all times. Let's see. Where am I? I think, let's see. The Apostle Paul tried to mimic Jesus Christ and his way of life. Now, he tried to do that after he was converted. And he was willing to do that even though Jesus Christ was persecuted and was killed. He was willing to do the same path if he followed in his steps and would get that kind of persecution. He was willing to take it. Now, he said that over in, he didn't say it in those words, but 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 1, I think we've quoted that, probably worn it out, but verse 1, 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 1, where the Apostle Paul wrote to the Corinthians and he says, "Imitate me, just as I also imitate Christ." Now, what if he doesn't imitate Christ? What if he makes a mistake and doesn't follow that? He didn't tell them to imitate that. "Imitate me as I follow Christ." And if I follow that kind of conduct, that kind of way of life, now follow that. That's what he's saying. Now, earlier in the book of Romans, he said, "The things I would, I do not, and the things I..." You think he didn't have problems? Sure he did. Just like you and I have. He had problems of conscience there that would prop up from time to time too. And we get habits fixed within us that are automatic reactions at times. And I wish I could say that I've overcome every one of those, so I don't have any of those anymore. Come on. We don't get rid of that. You know, you can't change the spots on the leopard. That's what they always say. There are certain things we just can't get out of us. And they're there. But we work at them. And as I said, I don't have the anger I used to have. I'd just fly off the handle and get angry at almost anything that came along. And I don't do that anymore. Mishnick temper was a horrible thing, I'll assure you of that. And I grew up with it. No doubt about it. I saw it all the way through the rest of the family and so forth. But Paul says, "Follow me as I follow Christ." That was important for him. That's what he wanted done. Philippians, the fourth chapter. Philippians, the fourth chapter. I love this passage. I love this fourth chapter of Philippians because of what the apostle, with the depth of feeling that the apostle Paul had here with these people. But in verse 8, he says, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, and if there's any virtue, and if there is anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things." That's the way we need to train our thinking, to think on those things. And as I said, he wrote the seventh chapter of Romans 2, where he says, "The things I would, I do not, and the things I would not, that I do." He knew that he was human like everybody else, and those human aspects would rise up viciously in him too sometimes. But he says, then he goes on to verse 9. He says, the things which you learned and perceived and heard and saw in me, these do, and the God of peace will be with you. Now, I love that because that's the way he wanted them to follow him, on these praiseworthy things. And I think all of us ought to want that as far as we are concerned too. If we were to do that all the time, then we become more and more converted. Our converted minds need to grow in that. They need to grow in those things, to grow in understanding them toward that end where we will follow Christ in whatever he did. Following the example of Jesus Christ then becomes easier and easier and more fruitful to each and every one of us.